problem is the time limits. I was hoping to do the program quickly, but unfortunately the program of Parliament keeps changing, and where we were going to have meetings, those have been taken away, and so we've had to fit in the hearings basically into 6 days. Today, tomorrow morning, next Tuesday morning, next Wednesday morning, the Tuesday and Wednesdays after that. So it's going to be spanning over 3 weeks, 2 days a week, to finish it. Now, I've already had some frantic calls, one particularly frantic call about someone who wanted to be here today and bring their submission and make a submission. This is a person that did not send a submission to us. Now, we've already agreed as a committee we're not accepting any further oral representations. But you should feel free to send written representations to us. Until we've finished our report, I don't mind receiving inputs and circulating them. I particularly am a bit worried, for example, business has given one input to us through BUSA. And I suppose that's not a bad thing, but the problem is with that kind of approach is we're going to lose a lot of nuances. I mean, you know, we would have preferred to have Sasol, to have Eskom, and those kind of industries here to actually to be able to answer to things. The problem is, you know, there's no problem doing it under BUSA. But the issues are that there are particular industries that need to, and you know, my worry about it is it's almost, you know, my first impression about it is almost as if people are hiding away and don't want to be dealing with the issues. Now, I think I'm probably totally wrong in saying that, so I don't intend saying that, but I want you to know that that's maybe what I'm thinking. Because, you know, I mean, these are serious things, man. And Sasol and Eskom and companies like that have a particular role to play in this country, and it's important that the representatives of the people out there are able to engage on issues. Now, someone told me that Eskom was at another meeting and they were shouted at and da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, well, so what, you know? I get shouted at all the time. By either one of my family members or one of my committee members. I don't actually cry about it. You just go home and you come in the next day. So I want you to know that we take these things serious, these issues seriously. And I know that I've now engaged Sasol and they are going to send me a separate, I think they may have sent it already. But the problem is we're not going to have the opportunity now to hear them. So really, I want to urge you to make sure if we have these kind of hearings that there is that kind of interaction. Now, the modus operandi of these meetings are that every representation is given more or less 45 minutes in total, strictly 45. Not 45 and 2 seconds, 45 or 5 seconds, 45 minutes. What that means is you make your whatever you want to say orally in 10 minutes, and the rest of the 35 minutes is left for questioning and answers, and we will stop so that we can fit in all 40 and give some equal time to all these representations. You know, if you really want to impress MPs, then it's always the best, whatever you've got to say, say what you want to say, disagree or agree with what you want to, and then give us solutions. And I must tell you, the best solutions, if you actually add text to your submission, if you say, I would like to see this in the submission, that's the best. Because then there's no misunderstanding of what you've said. We can actually see it. And you may find an MP that sits here that says, I like what's said there. The problem is if you just give a big submission, 50 pages, talk, and in the end of the day you walk away and, you know, forget it. So for you that are coming to make representations in your 10 minutes, Nothing stops you still to give us any written text that you're interested. That makes it much easier for everyone, and I think the chances of you hitting the jackpot may be better. Everything you say here in terms of recommendations and solutions, the department is recording for us, and we will then later on engage on those, each one of those, to see whether we agree or disagree with it and whether we think it has to be included in the in our final report. Unfortunately, venues in Parliament are difficult things to get hold of. So we do not have a specific venue all the time. So please check every day at the order paper where you have to be, where the meetings are taking place. I think they spread out all over Parliament during the course of the 3 weeks. And then I lastly want to just welcome a lot of guests amongst us here. We have Mr. Piet van der Walt, who is a Member of Parliament and he's the Deputy Chair of the Economic Committee and Natural Resources in the Namibian Parliament. He'll spend a little bit of time with us, so welcome, sir, and I hope that this is the start of a very fruitful linkage between our committees. And then we also have quite a few visitors here from the WEPA conference that has just finished yesterday. I will not remember everyone's name, and one of those names particularly is difficult to pronounce. So, Lord, I'm just going to say Lord C. I'm
going to not
Chichi. From the British Parliament, who's here, and very welcome, sir, and to the rest of all of you from the WEPA, welcome. All right, I think those are all the procedural issues. Members, any one of you want to raise any procedural issues before we start? We can go? Thank you. We have four submissions today. Dr. Chris Museki from the Water Research Commission. I thought, seeing as you're accountable to us, we'll call you first to see the quality of the work you produce so we can wrap you over the knuckles if it's not good enough. Weather services, same thing, also from one of our entities that is under us. That's the second input. It's Dr. De Blanche and Professor Dube. Then after the tea break, it's the Gender Commission, Dr. Yvette Abrams, who will present. And then the last of the day, with a song and a prayer, Dr. Reverend Keith Vermeulen will address us on behalf of the South African Council of Churches. I hope it's with a song and a prayer. The biggest rule in the committee is that your cell phone should never be heard, like mine. So you will please switch it off or put it on silent, as I'm doing. If your phone goes off after this, there is a bottle of water. We usually just put the cell phones in there, and you can then collect it afterwards. All right, Dr. Museki, are you over here?
Okay. Thank you very much.
You have 10 minutes. Please, don't make introductions. Don't thank us. Don't thank your mother for your birth. Just go to the points. That's all. Okay? 10 minutes.
Okay. I'll do it in 9 minutes. The other minute I'll dedicate it to just, in terms of introduction, I'm not the doctor. I'm just Mr. Museki.
Okay. Well, you've been promoted here on this form of mine.
Okay.
Secondly, stick to it. Don't be happy.
Okay. Secondly, I've got the written submission has been submitted, and it's in the same order and the numbering as the green paper. And then thirdly, there's a copy of the pack, there's a pack, a blue pack with copies of the presentation and other things. And lastly, there's an additional slide 10 of page 5 of the presentation that there were some errors in it and I've corrected it, so I put this in the pack. Just to start off, the focus of my presentation will only be on areas that need to be addressed, viewed from the water perspective. The first thing will be that... Okay. In terms of the arrangement of my presentation, the first thing that I'll talk to will be the seawater intrusions and impact, the potential impacts on water quality, as well as suggest the additional principle, which is the ecosystem approach principle. And then thirdly, the importance of the sector strategies that are detailed that needs to be developed by each sector to be in line with the national climate change response strategy that we have, but more detailed, to enable mainstreaming of climate change into existing policy. And then I'll talk to the additional items such as water quality, drinking water, and the mine water use, reuse, if you like, are also suggested. And then also the promotion and creation of enabling environment for public transportation as preferred mode of transportation in South Africa in terms of the key mitigation sector that I would transport. And then also the climate impact on biodiversity, and of course the issue of human settlement. Will also just comment on that in areas that are prone to extreme events with disastrous effects, and then lastly the skills development. I must say, in terms of the introduction, when we looked at the green paper, we find that all those elements that are important elements, such as, for example, the status of climate, the fact that South Africa is one of the driest countries in the world, and our dependency on the systems that are themselves vulnerable, as well as the importance of stabilizing the greenhouse gas emissions are very, very important. But what I've highlighted there is what we feel that is also important to really be explicitly expressed. Potential sea level rise resulting in saline intrusion of coastal aquifers does impacting on water quality and flooding low-lying settlements with potential disastrous implication for the poor people who normally settle there. And then in terms of the objective of the green paper, we feel that that is well articulated, because it seems to give effect to the constitutional provisions regarding the right to a safe environment and the future generations' right by balancing the question of ensuring fair attribution towards greenhouse gas stabilizations with the interventions or adaptation action to address climate change impact. As I said earlier, all principles mentioned, such as, for example, the precautionary principle, the people-centered principle, the polluter pay principles, and others, are well and good. But we feel that for this country, such as South Africa, with fragile ecosystem goods and services that supports communities' livelihoods, the ecosystem approach principle is also important, because in there you'd find that other human-induced impacts, such as pollution, are also considered in decision-making processes and ensures protection of ecosystem goods and services. And another point is that each strategy that is mentioned, I'm talking about now under climate change response strategy, such as the balanced approach to mitigation and adaptation responses, such as resource allocation, is okay. However, the emphasis on mainstreaming of climate change response into policy formulation and practice is very, very important. Taking issues into account when implementing government policies is a challenge, yet crucial. For example, it may be important to revisit international water sharing agreements if climate projections indicate that less water, for example, will be available in the future. So those agreements may not necessarily be valid if the climate, of course, changes. Now, my focus of my talk is actually on the adaptation sector water, because that's where we're coming from. Additional item on water quality suggested, for example, rising temperatures due to climate change could cause increased evaporation rate, thus leading to increased salt concentration or water quality deterioration. And, of course, high temperatures in nutrient-rich waters also promote eutrophication or algal blooms, if you like. And we feel that research and development, coupled with monitoring at various levels, should form part of the solution package for effective results. As, for example, the research communities do the research or investigate those areas that need further research, then, of course, the implementers needs to monitor the situation so that they can know what's happening. Now, some of the additional points that we have added, the drinking water quality, potable water, for example, both quality and as highlighted quantity and as highlighted quality are very, very important. It is now known that emerging pathogens, for example, are resistant to chlorine, including viruses and parasites and bacteria that cause various diseases. I've also cited some of the research results by the Water Research Commission in there. The impact of seawater desalination on marine ecology. Of course, water desalination is very important, especially along coastal areas, as an augmentation option. But one will have to very carefully manage the brine, the concentrated brine that could harm marine ecology. We all know internationally, for example, that the fishing Palestinian community's livelihood in Gaza is threatened by the return water that comes from the concentrated brine, in particular, coming from the Mediterranean desalination plant, and that can happen in South Africa. So as we use the technology, we also have to be mindful of the potential impact. And then, of course, the issue of water-energy nexus. Opportunities in increasing efficiency in water use and use of renewable energy such as solar and wind, etc. Nanotechnology is very, very important. I also have cited some of the WRC reports that are available in that regard. Increased average temperature could impact on the pathogens in the sense that they could actually promote the blooming of the pathogens as you have high temperature. So it's very important to enforce treatment of effluents to decrease potential impacts, such as waterborne diseases. Now, this is a slide that I have changed slightly because I realized that the second part of it was actually incorrect. Mine water use. Efficiency in water use, including recycling and reuse. Treated mine water is also a resource to augment supply. And, of course, the regulatory framework to enable treatment and reuse is very, very important. There are some of the research studies that I have cited there. Now, we know that Eskom, about a couple of years ago, and, of course, 2 years ago, they have indicated that they want to start this again, actually indicated that it's important perhaps to generate electricity using disused mines. Water is pumped from, for example, the mine below. In certain instances, like is the case in countries such as the United States, Japan, and others, in certain instances, they even use the sea level at the bottom. In other words, you have actually two storage. You have a storage at the top and storage at the bottom. During off-peak hours, you could pump water up, and then when, of course, during the peak hours, then you let that water gravitate down and turn the turbines to generate electricity. The examples are there on the board. Agriculture. It's very, very important to explicitly indicate that increased efficiency in agricultural water use is important. Stating the need for efficiency has to be very explicit, such as, for example, drip irrigation, and so on. Okay. And then, of course, on the transport side, as I said, it's important to... Okay.
Okay. Now you can see why you have to talk quick. 10 minutes goes very quickly,
okay.
And you need to emphasize the points. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I think this is an excellent summary of things. Unfortunately, not gone through. Of course, you can ask questions on any part of the submission, or anything on the slide, even if it's not been mentioned. So feel free. Who's going to start?
Thank you very much. much, Chairperson, for the first opportunity to speak. I think it's quite apt that we start off with a presentation, albeit brief presentation, on water. It's without doubt, in my opinion, the most important adaptation sector, but you've quite rightly said that there are issues of mitigation as well. The Water Research Commission has indeed, has a long history of research and provision of quality information and suggestions to policymakers. And indeed, I would think that much of your work over the recent years can feed quite easily into various policymaking forums on climate change. I mean, your work on eutrophication, water quality, and sewage. I'm also aware, one of the complex things, Mr. Chairperson, of asking the Water Research Commission is that they don't often like to give opinions, basically. They like to give us information and expect policymakers to use that information. So quite a slippery organization to actually ask opinions of. And I say that in complete good faith. It's really our job to listen to what the Water Research Commission is saying and indeed the executive. But having said that, let's ask you specifically about climate change. I particularly like the point, and it's the one point that I will take out of here, and I think we need to look at whether it is sufficiently addressed in various parts of this green paper, and that is about the efficiency of water use. Granted, there's lots to be said about recycling, and I'm not going to question you on that. I would like to ask you the following. Is it something that you are working on or are going to be working on, that you see the need of, to specifically look at the various economic sectors in South Africa? For example, mining, transport, trade and industry, energy in particular, and looking at sort of creating a baseline, benchmarks on what we as a country should regard as the acceptable efficiency levels in different economic sectors. I take, for example, your point on agriculture very well. Agriculture uses the majority of water in South Africa. Food security is very important, and the impacts of climate change suggest that we're in for some problems with agriculture in the future. So are you looking at those kind of what is an efficient use, so that policymakers, through both adaptation and mitigation, can actually look at particular sectors, possibly even legislate in the future, to say that this is what is, per GDP produced, this is really what an efficient use of water is. Granted, there's stacks of bylaws and other things which we as legislators can do to force people to use, and I think pricing is one thing legislators will have to look at more closely in the future. But are you going to give us some ideas on what is efficient in the future, if you have not already started working on that? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, let me start by welcoming the wonderful presentation that we got. As the presentation was going on, there was a Fed talks about the recycling of water. Now I just want to get the reuse of that particular water. On which purpose can we reuse that water? For humankind purposes or animals or plants? And what impact does it have to animals or people if they reuse that water? Because at the mines, at some stage you are talking about acid mine, a drainage, water, whatever. How does, in fact, what impact does that water has? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and I'd like to thank the MPs as well, and thank you very much, Mr. Morgan, for kind words. You did ask whether we actually are doing anything about ensuring that perhaps we look into the issue of various sectors' efficient use of water. I must say we haven't done anything as comprehensively as you would like it to happen, but we can. There's nothing stopping us in the future and even in the near future to perhaps do something about this. I think it's a good idea. We can do that. The WRC can do that because our research is normally informed by what the public say and what other people say, what the government is saying. We listen to the president's sona, we look at what the minister has in mind, and we look at other things. So it's informed by the needs. So recognizing that as a need, I think we will pay attention to that. But there are some elements of efficient use that we looked at, like in agriculture here and there. There's just some clusters of excellence there and there, but nothing as comprehensive as you put it. So we'll look into that. In terms of Honorable Mr. Skosana's question, I think it's a very good and valid question as well. Well, when we talk about the reuse of water, we're talking about first you have to treat it. You have to ensure that it's fit for a particular use. In certain instances where you cannot treat your water to the level to which it can become perhaps prohibitively expensive to make it potable or of drinking standard, at least you have to make it useful for other things like agriculture and other things. And even if you use it for agriculture, one has to be mindful of, as you rightly put it, the impact, the potential impact. Does it have too much sodium, perhaps, which might not be suitable for agriculture? We've got to look at those things. But the point is that it's very important to recycling, actually, it's relatively cost-effective compared to just concentrating on supply rather than that approach. And then, of course, Advocate Lange, you have two questions, and you are asking about the implication on the viability and the issue of cost. The wave action, the desalination. In many countries, this is happening, but desalination is one of the expensive, relatively expensive, but not as expensive as putting up a dam, for example. And it would also be perhaps, well, a dam is too big, of course. I take your point, really. And, of course, I think the technology is also changing and improving with time. And with time, the cost of desalination will decrease as the technology improves. I think it's especially in the Arab world, I know that the UAB, the United Arab Emirates, is using not only desalination, but they use other things like, for example, rainfall enhancement, which the source Doctor. I think my friend here will talk to it, perhaps. But it's used in other countries, especially those countries that are dry countries. It's used a lot. Some countries actually exclusively depend on desalinated water. And the issue of using the mines to in terms of generation of electricity, it's happening in some other countries. It is just one of the options. You can't use any of this as the only option, but there are several countries where this has been happening. And of course, as I indicated, ESCOM is considering that. But of course, when one looks into that, one will have to look, as you rightly said, into the issue of feasibility. And I think in South Africa, it might even work because South Africa has one of the deepest mines, you know, which means that as the water gravitates down, it will have maybe a greater force. And this might be, I'm very optimistic that the technology can be feasible in certain instances. Sasol is considering doing that.
I think your chairperson, I also like to thank you for your presentation. For your remark, your remark is just say each sector, including the water, should be have the strategy. I like from the your side, your research side, can give us more clear what the strategy for the each sector you will be highlighted, especially for the water quality and water climate change response. So I think from your research side, you will be amended for some of the insight items, but the special for the research strategy, what do you highlight for the in the green paper in the thing?
Thank you very much. Thank you for your previous answer. I'm interested. I know I've seen it before, and I'm interested if you're involved and if it is and if you are, whether it's something that you're continually updating as well. I'm aware that, I mean, you previously said, oh well, desalinization is cheaper than building a dam, but there are a whole bunch of different ways to deliver water. Augmentation, so it's bringing it somewhere, taking it somewhere, recycling, desalinization, and a whole bunch of others. Pulling icebergs could be one of them, quite frankly. Are you involved in actually regularly looking at the relative costs of the various ways of delivering water, as you quite correctly said, for specific goals? I mean, I'm not necessarily talking about water to a potable standard in every sense. I think we're going to have to increasingly get used to, in South Africa, using different standards of water for different economic activities, quite frankly. So is that something you are working on as well? Once again, it links from my previous comment. It's useful for policymakers to be able to have those relative costs going forward, because I think my sense is we're only now moving into a time when we're going to be looking more actively at the other alternatives. I mean, augmentation, presumably there are limits to what can be done, and the issues of recycling and desalinization, which has been mentioned already, will increasingly be looked at. So that's my first part. The second part is particularly to do with recycling. How far, and perhaps this is a question I accept for the Department of Water and indeed the Minister, but you might know something about it. How far are we away from actually authorizing as a country or permitting the mixing of recycled sewage water to an acceptable standard back into a bulk water supply? I'm aware that there is a project in the Eastern Cape, I think it's in Alexandra, where they have been trying to get official approval to actually use water.
water from the sewage plant recycled to a standard. I actually think it's the drinking water, funny enough. But where are we on that? Because there are already localized areas where there are crises, Beaufort West, parts of the Eastern Cape, spring to mind, which are now little test cases for business unusual, which are going to become more widespread under future climate change predictions. And if anything, they present good opportunities now to very meaningfully look at the alternatives, not just augmentation or trucking water, but actually using recycled water for productive purposes, if not for human consumption, I think.
Thank you, Chair. You know, one for me is as a water research, commission, that you are talking about South Africa being one of the countries that is, is very scarce, in water resource. My question is, have you done any research in terms of the water, that is, is wasted through leakages, so that one can be able to know the quantities and, that we are losing, so that can be brought to the attention of the department and of government, because they are talking about water, quality of water and efficiency, in water, and all the time when we have got, presentations, from the department and the number of entities, we always hear a lot about the water that is being wasted through leakages and sometimes running through the streets for a couple of days, not one day. I've made a mention, for instance, of Fifth Street in Sandton. You drive up and the water is just pumping, up high for a couple of days, not for one day. Is there, as a researcher, have you done anything about that to establish and what measures are put in place to actually curb that?
Thank you, Chair. Dr. Hong, the strategy that I'm referring to for the sector is the climate change response strategy that each sector, like for example the water should have, the agriculture should have, the energy should have, on how they are going to respond to climate change within their own situation. Now, for the water, it would have to take into account the status of our water resources as South Africa and the status of our water use. All important elements around water they'll have to take into account in that strategy. And of course, also consider the research outcomes or the research results based on the projections that various, for example, universities and the researchers have produced, like the projections on what is likely to happen, even if those projections are uncertain, but at least they give us an indication of what is likely to happen. In other words, the strategy should be a way of saying how now that we have
climate, we as a country, we are faced with high climate variability. We are likely to have climate change with devastating effects as a country and as a region, to say, what are we going to do to ensure that we sustainably manage and still use our water resources? So that strategy will have to help to mainstream all these elements of climate change into water management as a whole. So that is the strategy that I'm talking about. And so it would go with the energy sector to say, in terms of mitigation, what kind of mitigation options are we going to put in place, or as transport or whoever, what are we going to put in place in order to respond appropriately to the climate change, to ensure that we do something about the climate change impacts? Now, Mr. Morgan, in terms of the options for supply, I think most of your questions, actually, you talked about, for example, the relative cost. The Department of Water Affairs has got has done a lot of work on this, and they have some information on this. I think most of the questions that you have asked will have to provide the written comments, because one will not have to just to say, okay, we have done it, or it's also in there, but without providing the figures, because what I think you need, or what I understand, what I guess you need when you're talking about the relative cost on various ways, in I think it's important for me to send this in writing if it's acceptable. And then, of course, the recycling. How far are we in terms of authorizing the mix of recycled water to an accepted standard? Again, I know that the Directorate of Water Use within the Department of Water Affairs has some information on this. And I think I'm not sure how far in terms of the authorization. I think one will have to interact with the department and again, provide written comments to Parliament on this issue. Research on what percentage of water is recycled compared to other water users. Yes, indeed, there is some information on these things, but we are dealing here with a moving target, because we may have conducted the research, say, for example, in 2007 to say the recycled water compared to other uses is this much, but it could have changed by now. But there is some information on these things, which I think I can be. I think it depends on where you are in the country. If you are in the I don't know nationally, I don't know the I don't have the national picture with me on how much on what it is. Yes, I can do that. I can do that. What I can tell you is that, in, for example, if you look at what's happening in the Limpopo and look at what's happening in other in various regions, you find that there is variation in terms of how much of recycled water is being used compared to other options like groundwater and water and of course surface water. Honorable Ms. Ndude, the scarcity of water, research in terms of water wastage through leakages. Again, there is quite a lot of not only this year. I mean, recently, I think more than once we have more than one report on this as well. But you know, on leakages, and some of this information has actually been incorporated into the department's approaches to how they deal with the issues of leakage. We know that in some instances you would find up to 30, even 40%, if you look at the municipalities where a lot of water is being lost through leakages, in some instances through other things like, for example, illegal use of water. To establish measures on what should be put in place, I mean, the research always have also the recommendations on what needs to happen, and I think, again, it's a matter of, if you really wanted to know what is happening, I think it's a matter of also following this up as a written response, because, I mean, otherwise I don't want to guess the figures to say it's this much and that. It might. If it's okay, I'll send written responses to these questions.
Thank you, Mr. Moseka. I found a lot of the things you said very interesting. Whatever else you would want to send us, please feel free to do so, and particularly the information would be valuable. And obviously, as one of our entities, we may call upon you for more information. But thank you for the efforts, and thank you for coming and presenting. Sorry that you were the guinea pig, but you came out of it unscathed. Next input is Dr. De Blanche and Professor Dube. Is it these two characters sitting here? Are you just going to talk or you want to?
We're just going to talk.
Okay, then you can sit there.
Chair, thank you. Being second, I assume, doesn't mean that we are the pigs there. We have provided a short three-page...
Sorry, just before you... It's worth just looking at the last slide of Mr. Moseka. Those of you that have the input. Mr. Moseka, just show that last slide to them. This is particularly important to all people that are animal lovers. This is revenge. Basically, it's... don't worry. It's a man sitting on an island catching fish, and two sharks are sitting there reading something, and it's called sea level rise, and they're saying, well, don't worry, in the next 5 years we can just swim over there and eat them. So that is one of the things that could happen soon. It appealed to my sense of humor. There we are. All right. Thank you very much. Now, again, we can start again, Doctor.
Thank you, Jay. We provided a short three-page comments on the green paper, starting off by saying that we believe that this is a very good basis to start from. Before we get into some of the detailed comments, I would like to highlight two very important issues. I think if one considers a future uncertain climate, we've got some indications of what this climate will mean for us in South Africa and Southern Africa. We need to realize that we often have problems to cope with the present climate of the region. And the statistics which indicate that 90% of all the disasters that impact on people and infrastructure in South Africa are weather-related is a good indication that we don't fully cope with the present climate. So it's important then to realize that one of, especially in light of the uncertainty of some of the climate predictions, that one of the best ways to adapt for a new climate, a future climate, is to learn to deal with the current climate and its variability in Southern Africa. This implies that one needs to strengthen existing systems in the country that feeds the disaster management structures in the at all levels of government, and this actually implies as well that the country needs a strong weather service to provide the forecasts and warnings at all timescales. The second very important issue, if one takes a step back from the whole issue, and related to what Chris spoke about before, is that we must realize that the atmosphere is the primary source of fresh water in South Africa. In terms of water resources, South Africa can be seen as an island with no major rivers that flow into the region from other climatic zones. So we are dependent on the rainfall that falls over South Africa to feed our catchments and feed our rivers. And therefore, it's very important to be able to manage the water resources in South Africa, that you need to know what comes into the system. And that again implies that the infrastructure and the observing networks in South Africa needs to be strengthened to allow catchment management authorities for the future and water affairs also to do a proper job. So I think those are two central messages that we would like to convey in terms of the Green Paper, is the realization of our current weaknesses in the current climate system, and how, if we strengthen systems to deal with that, it will actually be to our benefit in the future. And the other issue is that water is got its main source in the atmosphere. So when one goes to the specific input, I'll go to the second one because we've actually, the first one is related to what I've spoken about. We also have a very large natural climate variability at all timescales. The natural variability in the climate system of Southern Africa is much larger than the projected change that we can expect in average conditions for the future. But I think what is very important to realize is that the variability that we sit with now between seasons and weeks and months and days will also change in the future. And if you look at any system, it's not the average conditions that have the biggest impact on such systems, but it's the extreme events. It's the periods of drought and the periods of floods that drive changes in various systems and places stress on the system. The third comment is related to what I believe is a very important issue is that in South Africa we shouldn't necessarily look at creating new structures and institutions to deal with the issue of weather, climate and water or climate change, but we should make sure that the institutions that are primarily mandated to play a leading role in these issues are properly capacitated. And we should also look closely at the international community and also what the World Meteorological Organization has said in terms of its global framework for climate services. There are some clear guidelines of best practices in that regard. The fourth input is related to the fairly optimistic view, we believe, to say that we're going to run into serious water problems by 2050. To our best knowledge, the date for this has always been stated to be much closer to 2025. And especially if we can't address certain issues in efficiency and losses in the water articulation system in the country, I think it would be very unwise to think that that 40 years or 39 years from now, water is going to become a central issue. It's already becoming so in many parts. I've mentioned the additional input related to point four, but I think what is important there is to highlight that the atmosphere is a very large source of fresh water, and that only about 10% of the moisture that moves across South Africa or the subcontinent actually falls out as rainfall over the subcontinent. So 90% of the moisture is transported across our region of the world. And I think there should also be a realization, and it should be included in future water strategies, that South Africa is a recognized leader in several non-conventional water augmentation technologies, including water harvesting from fog for small rural communities where the climate allows that, and also rainfall enhancement where South Africa has made pioneering work in the past. The fourth input is related to a lack of emphasis, we believe, on the wind energy potential. There's a lot spoken about solar energy, but there's also wind energy potential in South Africa. And there's indications, as also set out in some of the WMO, World Meteorological Organization documentation, that a minimum threshold of 3 meters per second is sufficient for wind energy generation that can be used for water pumping and electricity generation. So using that prescript, most of the coastline of South Africa actually qualifies for this. The sixth input is related to the optimal use of weather information in flight planning to ensure economic and safe flight paths with minimum fuel usage. I think this is very important. Aircraft fly in the atmosphere where the winds can often exceed or approach a few hundred kilometers an hour, and that's why you often see the very high ground speeds that is achievable. So optimal use of weather information in flight planning is a very effective mitigation issue in terms of the transport industry. The second input is related to the undesirable situation in South Africa that we really have a population that are not well equipped to identify and take basic precautionary actions regarding hazardous weather conditions related to lightning, heavy rainfall, etc. And that there's a structured and multi-stakeholder public awareness campaign desperately needed in this regard. To give an example, in South Africa we lose about 150 people a year due to lightning, which is three times as high as in the U.S. Comparing the population of the U.S. with that of South Africa, and realizing that the U.S. has been able to reduce the lightning deaths over the last 100 years, it clearly is an indication that there's something wrong in South Africa. On a particular summer day, you can easily get as many as 300 lightning strokes across South Africa, so it is not possible to issue warnings for individual lightning strokes, but there are precautionary and fairly simple knowledge that can be used to avoid being killed by lightning. The eighth input is related to the capacity, the human capacity related to climate change scientists, atmospheric ocean modelers. We should never forget that the oceans around us, for which we also have a responsibility in terms of many issues, including forecasting, is one of the largest of any country in the world of responsibility. We need more air quality scientists, because air quality being an issue in itself in South Africa, but it's also closely linked with climate change. Hydrometeorologists, in other words, those kind of people that can link the atmosphere with hydrology on the surface. Agrometeorologists, people that understand the links between weather and agriculture. And then the ninth input is related to issues regarding the weather and climate observation infrastructure, which is not optimally coordinated and even funded in South Africa. If one takes a close look at this, you can see that there's quite a lot of infrastructure in South Africa being deployed by various organizations, and this makes it very difficult for an organization like the South African Weather Service, that is the custodian of the National Climate Database, to ensure that all this data flows in a common data format and through common data quality procedures. The other input that we provided is we just felt that it's important to emphasize the role and the responsibility that the South Africa Weather Service has in terms of disaster management and other issues related to warnings for the public. So maybe Prof. Dube might have something to add.
Do we still have time? A minute or two, Prof?
Now Dr. Tetlan, she has covered most of the comments on this.
You're going to answer the questions. Okay. Now, if you look at that submission, you'll see that it's exactly done in the form of text, which is very useful. And some interesting things come out of it. Questions? Mr. Morgan, Dr. Kalyan, Mr. Swasana.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to the Weather Service for that presentation. Indeed, you have an important role to play in a number of things, gathering data for science, modeling, predictions, long-term forecasting, and in helping to warn people about extreme weather events, among other things. First thing first, you have access to a lot of data, you collect a lot of data, and you also, under the SOARS Act, have an imperative to commercialize. Now, in the world we're living in, when there's a great public good in making sure that we model as accurately as possible future climate predictions, are you going to be, as a public service, providing data relevant to future climate modeling to anyone who wants it for free? I'd be very interested in your answer to that. No, I don't see why you have to hold it from those who want to model these things in the future. Secondly, this is a question really to your own ability actually to effectively manage extreme weather events. And it's got to do with the issue of cost saving in your own organization. I mean, we as legislators may have to look at your organization and whether to transfer more money to it. But of course, I know that there's pressure on you to commercialize and bring in your own fees. But, I mean, I have some issues about whether you have sufficient capacity at the moment or are doing a good enough job on upper air soundings. And for the other people in the room, upper air soundings are important to obtain vertical profiles of the atmosphere in terms of pressure, temperature, humidity, and wind speed and direction. And this information is used in combination with other sources of information on the atmosphere, atmosphere structure, and used input into numerical weather prediction models. Now, in August 2009, you cut the number of upper air soundings for explicitly cost-saving reasons. Can you reassure us that under a situation of increased unpredictability of weather, that there are sufficient soundings going on? And are you going to actually work to a position where you're going to increase the number of upper air soundings? Then the last issue is, you raised a very interesting point, and I hadn't really thought about it before, on the role you can play in mitigation from air travel, in the sense of giving the right information in order to direct paths of airplanes. One of the issues I have in that regard is that your information is very well accessible to pilots at large airports, OR Tambo and Durban. But, I mean, there must be hundreds of airports in South Africa, Chairperson, hundreds, that do not have access to the internet at this time. I mean, not don't have ready access to the internet. And I accept that there's opportunities for mitigation from air travel. And in that sense, what is the Weather Service doing to make it easier for pilots taking off from airstrips all around South Africa, if not Southern Africa, to access reliable weather data using other forms? So, for example, Mobi sites on their cell phones. Because it does seem like you are restricting the ability of pilots to reliably access data, people who take off at small airstrips around South Africa. I thank you.
Doctor?
Thank you. I have been covered partly in my question around capacity, but I just want to take it, your point eight. You say it's a desperate need in South Africa. Now, are these skills on the scarce skill list? And what is the solution? I mean, is it there are very few people that are graduating as climatologists or science, climate change scientists. I don't think it's the degree exists as a whole per se. How do you see us resolving that, given that climate change is so much on the agenda these days? And then on point 11, SARS is committed to continuing to develop and improve the early warning system. Now, the system as it exists now, does it exist? Is it functional? And what are the deficits? Because given the recent floods and the damages that happened there, it's clear that we are lacking. So I'd like to hear some comment on you. And then thirdly, is it fair to compare South Africa and Britain in terms of the lightning, given the makeup of this land, of South Africa, given the rural makeup, you know, with open spaces and given that there, you know, there's not brick structures all over compared to Britain?
Chairperson, I'm partly covered on some questions. I'll just make an addition here and there. Chairperson, my question was on floods and aircraft. Is that they are happening all the time in the country? And we have got the weather service company, which is always studying the weather in our company. Now my question was, is there any means of give a prior information before this incident happening in terms of floods and aircrafts. Because really, except in the screen of our TVs and so on, but it's the any means that are made so that people can be aware and be removed in those areas where a flood can take place or a strong wind can come and invade them. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Dr. Fong, Ms. Ndude.
Thank you, Chairperson. Regarding for the, you want an additional for the point, for the page 20, after this 5.6.9. Is there encourage for the, this weather information in the flight plan? I'm not quite sure. It's all now, it's all the flight plan. They all the flight. They have the all the information before they fly. All the this weather information. So why you need to add the, this one in the, this green paper? So the, you just highlight for the utilize the minima for the, this huge usage. But I think from the 5.68 already we had the fuel tax and ecology for the this cleaner fuel. This I think it is a quite. But I just not understand why you still highlight for the flight information for the weather, because this one normally this flight all got this information. Thank you.
Ms. Ndude.
Thank you, Chair. I think mine will is more linked to to capacity and expertise. You know, South African Weather Services actually celebrated, I think it was this year or last year, celebrated 150 years of its existence. And therefore, you know, it means, for me, I would understand that it's really supposed to be far ahead, because I think there was something that says it's the oldest. Is it oldest in the Southern Africa or in the continent or in the world? In terms of its existence, or in the continent, okay. So therefore, it's really supposed to be far ahead in terms of the technology that it is using. I'm saying this in relation to, you know, lightnings, because they are very, very common. And I remember that the last you know, time we received a presentation from the South African Weather Services, I think it was early this year or just late last year. We were talking about people being creative in terms of taking the awareness to the communities, especially in the areas, because it's not all the nine provinces, it's not the entire South Africa that have got, you know, lightnings, you know. There are certain parts of the country that at a particular time they are affected by lightnings. And the issue was, what is the South African Weather Services doing, you know, about that? We made a number of suggestions and examples that were made by this committee to, you know, the members of the South African Weather Services that came to make the presentation. And I read somewhere here in your presentation where you are talking about the need for actually stakeholders coming together to do something. For me, the issue is you are supposed to be leading in that. What have you done so far, you know, about that? Because you've been in existence now for 150 years, and you know exactly that it will be either Limpopo, KZN, certain parts of the Eastern Cape that are very much affected by lightning at a particular, you know, period, you know, of the year. And I think I would really want to hear, you know, what action or what plan have you got, you know, in place to actually make the communities, you know, aware. Somebody even made, I think it was Honorable Morgan or somebody, I think it was the chairperson, who said you actually need to have, you know, a weatherman, maybe on the television, in the newspapers, when the weather is changing, that when people see that, like you even made example about the electricity, you know, saving electricity, that you are watching your television and at the bottom of the screen of your television, there's a green light that says, you know, in the Western Cape or this particular area, switch off the lights or you're saving the electricity, well. So, examples were made to say something, that the South African, weather service can actually be able to do that is visible, that people at a particular time in those areas can be able to see and they say, oh, there is the weatherman. So that means something is coming and they listen to that. If you can, please talk to us about that. Thank you.
Thank you. Just quickly, I think you should just tell me where you get this 2025. I want to follow that up. Who says that? Secondly, when you say here that we must strengthen existing institutions, I understand what you're saying. I'm trying to think which institutions, other than wanting more money for the weather services, but which institutions are you saying is a weak link at the moment? I think it's important that we know that, whatever your view is on it. Thirdly, the issue of database. I'm one of those people that continuously harp on this. Too much of government's policy making and activities is based on assumptions and a whole lot of other issues, and not necessarily on hard data. I am very much of the view that what you're stating here may be important, that you have a solid database. But I think that there must be, and I've raised this very strongly with the department when they raised last week came and gave the input to us, that part of what we must actually have in this paper is a central database, particularly probably under the Department of Environment, where all the information on weather patterns, on water, on flooding, all the kind of things that are climate change related or could be climate change related, that we have actually a single database. Now, in this area where the different databases are. What is the feasibility of that, and how quickly would we be able to do something like that, pulling together these databases? Of course, there may be gaps which we have to fill in. And then the last one is the one Ms. Ndude raises. I do think everyone that you talk to about climate change, no one can particularly link the floods the other day, for example, to climate change. But the frequency of droughts, of floods, of those things are clearly indicators that the climate is changing in the world and the patterns are changing. Now, it's very clear that we're going to face more and more and more disasters and those kind of things. You don't have to be a genius to start seeing this. My worry is that no one in government takes leadership position on communicating this information to us. You may communicate amongst yourselves. You may communicate with environment. You may communicate with foreign affairs to tell Mozambique that something's happening. You may communicate with your disaster centers. But the problem is the vast majority of people are not getting that information. Now, this is the point that Mrs. Ndude has raised. Shouldn't one of your points here be that the visible communication of things related to climate change should become a high priority in government? Whether it's you in weather services that does it or it's done somewhere else, I'm not particularly worried about it. I mean, the department has started addressing this already to us, and they getting budgets and things to do that. But, for example, during the floods, I expect when that weather comes up on the weather thing, I expect someone to sit there and say, we have now got more rain in Lesotho, we've had more rain here, we've had more rain there. We expect this rain to start in 2 days impacting in Douglas. Someone should start analyzing and actually telling our people, what's happening. The problem is you guys are keeping it amongst each other, and I'm not saying that maybe you don't do it well enough. But the point is, I'm not a big fan of a lot of things American. But I'm telling you one thing about America. Give them a disaster, and they communicate. Of course, they use it for a whole lot of things. Giuliani was quite clever with the thing. He made a mate. But the point of the fact is, no one during that won't know what is happening, because there's someone continuously
on the weather service is saying this is happening, there's rain, yeah, we're expecting this. Now, for me, it's a vital, whether you do it or whether the department does it, if something has to be discussed in government, where are we going to coordinate this? That we have a face. Whether it's Dr. de Blanche, who's now becoming the face in South Africa, that when we see you in the street, we know there goes Mr. Weather, there goes Mr. Storm, who's now going to tell us when the next storm is coming. But, you know, it's very vital. I just think it's actually atrocious when we have these disasters in the country that there's no face, there's no leadership that telling us these things are happening. So this is an issue I want very strongly addressed as well. All right, there you are. A whole lot of questions. Please answer. May I welcome Mr. Barry Garden. He's an MP from and used to be a minister in the Labour government. He's still an MP in Britain. Very well known in climate change circles, so welcome. With Chairperson Johnson, and I saw Chairperson Njikalani also right somewhere. Where is he? There he is, right in front of me. Welcome to all of you, and please, not Barry, but the rest of you can, of course, the chairs can participate and ask questions. Yes, answer your questions, please.
Mr. Morgan, you asked very relevant questions about issues related to data and the complex dual mandate that the South African Weather Service have in terms of public good and commercial services. And it might be good that our colleagues from the UK is also here because they might know some of the same debates that has taken place in the UK. This dual mandate is a very complex thing, but I personally believe when it comes to issues like climate change, that we need to view these issues as national issues in the public interest, and those activities and the data around that should be made available as part of the public good mandate. In terms of the upper soundings, yes, I'm very aware of the cutback that we had in 2009. If you look for somebody to blame, you can actually blame me because I implemented that cost saving at that stage. We've reverted back to a more optimal sounding program after that. I think it's also important to realize that upper air soundings, where you attach a radio sonde on a balloon, is still a very important part of upper air data collection in meteorology. But the technology has also allowed us to do upper air soundings from satellite technology over at least the ocean areas that surround us. So the vast information and the improvement in models in the southern hemisphere is mostly due to satellite upper air information that has been achieved. In terms of the access of normal general aviation pilots to weather information, we are working through the regulator as well in addressing issues related to this. And the Weather Service has also got a partner that has got expertise in the use of cell phone technology and other technologies that makes it easier for pilots to access that information. But it will be at a minimal cost. But I think that is to be accepted. I think Prof. Dube will help me with the next one.
Dr. Kaelan asked a question on skills. She pointed out correctly that atmospheric science is a scarce skill in the country and very, very critical for our business as the South African Weather Service. We have a dedicated human capital development unit at the South African Weather Service to look into beefing up skills so that our business continues. I can point out now that we have a working relationship with the University of Pretoria, where we are funding students from undergrad to postgrad levels. We also have a working relationship with University of Fort Hare and the University of Zululand, where we are also funding students at postgrad and undergrad level in order to beef up skills in atmospheric science. It is not only atmospheric science that has become the business of the Weather Service. We have also obtained an extended mandate with regard to air quality. And in that respect, we are having students, funding students at the University of the Witwatersrand, as well as Potchefstroom. So we are conscious of the fact that we need to beef up skills if we are to maintain the kind of service that is expected of us as the South African Weather Service. Thank you.
I think also related to the skills issue, I don't believe that we always find the most talented young people in the country opting for this as a career. And it should actually be one of the most exciting careers in the 21st century. But without a face, as the chair has mentioned, it might be one of the problems. No, I believe that for a scientist, interested in atmospheric science, the whole issue of climate science implies a very exciting career where such a person can make a difference to other people's lives. In any case, you also asked a question regarding the early warning system. Yes, the South African Weather Service does have an early warning system in place. It was upgraded in the past year. You will in the near future also see that we will use a color coding system to indicate the difference between alerts and warnings. And we've also just introduced in October last year the South African flash flood guidance system that deals with the most flood-prone areas in South Africa. And even in the past season, the system has been very helpful in our interactions to allow disaster management to be more effective in how they go about their business. You also mentioned something about lightning. The Weather Service operates an extensive national lightning detection network, so we indeed can identify the areas where the lightning risk is at its highest. This, of course, is not only important in saving lives or designing communication and public awareness programs, but it's also very important for industries like Eskom to make sure that they are effective in distributing the limited electrical power across South Africa. Mr. Kosana spoke about the floods, and we saw a lot of that in the current summer season. I think it's important also to realize that the South African Weather Service is a global producing center for long-range forecasts, only one of three in the Southern Hemisphere. And in springtime already, we gave indications to our sister departments and also the public that we expect above normal rainfall and even some areas with extreme rainfall in this summer season. So I think South Africa should have been well warned about the potential of flooding in this season. Dr. Hong, you mentioned the issue regarding use of weather information in aviation. Yes, this is very true. All commercial flights and all instrument-rated flights need to have weather information for flight planning purposes. But I think it's very important that this information is better used. You often still find aircraft in South Africa in a holding pattern above an airport like Oliver Tambo International on a short flight from Durban or Cape Town, so clearly the weather information that was available indicating that storms are approaching Oliver Tambo International was not fully considered when that flight took off from the departing airport. So there is still quite room for improvement in this whole system. Ms. Mduni, I just want to see your surname. Mduni, you spoke about lightning awareness and the fact that the South African Weather Service is already 151 years old now. It's very true that we should be more active in terms of getting out the message. You will also see in my submission, and I didn't mention numbers there, but we have a total staff of just more more than 160 people that operate 24 hours a day across South Africa in many locations. So we need to partner our communication drive with other sectors in government. And in the recent past, there has been communications between the Weather Service and the government communication. The government communication and information in the presidency. So we have been talking to them on how we can improve this awareness amongst the people of South Africa. I think it should be said fairly frankly that the South African, that the SABC is probably in the same position as the Weather Service in terms of its dual mandate in, of a public and a commercial mandate. And when the South African Weather Service is in contact with the SABC, the SABC sees the airtime that it provides to the Weather Service as time that it advertised the Weather Service. So let's be frank about these things. I think these are the sort of things that we need to talk about in South Africa and make sure that the South African Weather Service and the SABC as the public broadcaster works together to get messages out and allow time to get messages out to inform people and save lives. I will have to go and find the reference on 2025. I will send it to you. The existing institutions, I believe it is the Weather Service and the Department of Water Affairs, especially. I think we all realize that water is the central issue that then has got downstream implications to agriculture and industry, etc. It's interesting that internationally, and you mentioned the example of the US, they have combined issues of weather and water in one government body. Now, we report to one minister, but we are not in one department. So even the World Meteorological Organization not only deals with weather and climate issues, but it also deals with water issues. So there might be some lessons there of where we need to go in future in South Africa. In terms of the visibility of a communicator that talks about weather and climate issues, I think this is very true. I think this is related to what my fairly harsh comment on the SABC issue, but I think this is something that needs to be followed up. I must, however, mention that there's a risk and vulnerability atlas available in South Africa with links to various databases. And the South African Weather Service is also on the steering committee of the Risk and Vulnerability Atlas that talks about all types of risks and provides information on that. I hope I've answered most of them.
Yes, can I patch up a few things there and there? With regard to the question on from Advocate De Lange on strengthening existing institutions. I can mention that we have started a relationship with ARC and the Department of Water Affairs. We are working towards coordinating observations between the three organizations. We have already established technical working groups on instrumentation, on data exchange, on products and services and research, and we've identified areas of cooperation. In as far as topics that are related to adaptation to climate change. The question on 2025, I think there is work that was done by Bruyere, who used to work for the Weather Service, who did sterling work on making those projections, but we'll come back to you with the exact reference in that regard. There was also a question around building a solid database. I just want to mention very quickly here that the department has given us a mandate to host the South African Air Quality Information System, whose aim is to coordinate all quality information from that is being monitored by municipalities, by the private sector, as well as government. It's a very exciting project for us. We already have 42 stations that are reporting to the SACWIS, and we're moving ahead with the next phase of the SACWIS, which is the National Emissions and Inventory, which will speak directly to your climate change research efforts, and because you'll have your greenhouse gases being stored into that database. There was also another point on, maybe I can mention this one very quickly, on comparing ourselves with the U.S. In terms of lightning, given our makeup. I can just submit here that we have a point here, one of the points that we have raised in our submission is that we need to have a rigorous, well-structured, multi-stakeholder public awareness campaign, and the South African Weather Service will be already there are processes that are ongoing between the South African Weather Service and the Department of Environmental Affairs, and they would like to, would be very, very happy and very excited to participate in those kinds of fora. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. That's good timing also. You know, this thing about communication, man, you know, you can go and talk to the presidency, of course, and it's important to talk to the presidency. But you are the custodian of the information which can show which risks and vulnerabilities exist. I mean, you've mentioned foyer. You mentioned the weather. You've mentioned lightning. You've mentioned the air quality. And you've mentioned the issue of floods. Now, we have to have a face on these and these communication things. So you must know that when I call you again before the committee, there's going to have to be some action. You can talk to the presidency about other things, what have to, but on communication, you have this information. You must communicate and get it sorted out with SABC. If you've got problems, tell us with SABC. We'll talk to them. But thank you very much. I think your input has been very professional, very well done, and it's going to assist us. And thanks for all your efforts. Ladies and gentlemen, you will now have a chance to go and have comfort breaks. There are little places down there you can go into, and if you want to do things, there's tea and coffee outside, and we'll be back in about 10 minutes.
Yeah. Knowledge on the
thing. Well, I don't know. I don't know.
Okay, can we sit down?
Yeah.
You should have been able to network. It's the easiest way to do it is just take the person's cell number, send your number to them, and say, whenever you want to talk to me, then this is, you can do this. That's the easiest way to do it. Which, where's the, good, what number? 33. Is it, yeah. Hey, you've got a lot of church ones here, but you haven't got the original, right? The original. Yeah, no, no, I'm aware. All right, are we settled? Suddenly there are a few people. Where are they? Just shout outside there. Get out of those corners and come back. All right. Okay, welcome to the Gender Commission. Dr. Abrams, nice seeing you again, in a different capacity now. I see there's another little summary you've done. This one? No, this is not the one. This one, yeah. It's on the screen, it's this one. You should have it on your desk. Plus, it is submission number 33, the original submission, 33. Okay, over to you, Doctor.
Thank you, Chairperson. All protocol observed. This is a joint submission with the Gender and Energy Network South Africa and the Gender Climate Change South Africa, Women for Climate Justice. These are civil society organizations. I'm just going to skip through because I want to devote most of my presentation to the last two slides. In our pre-green paper process, we submitted to Environmental Affairs the notion that climate change is caused by human behavior. That was, in fact, taken up in the Green Paper. We're still trying to push Environmental Affairs to proceed to the next logical conclusion, which is the minute you're born, you have some form of gender. And so if what we're talking about is human behavior change, we are going to need to address issues of gender and inequalities of power between the genders. We go on to say that climate change affects the poorest of the poor, and, you know, I've got reams of statistics to show that the poorest of the poor are women. Poverty has a female face. Jumping straight to the recommendations, I'm not going to go into the detail, just to say that we have a bit of a concern that the planning team in Environmental Affairs that wrote the pre-green paper and the green paper appears to be entirely male. When we called the Department for Employment Equity hearings 2 weeks back, we raised this because the department, in fact, has one of the best records for employment, for gender equity in employment in the whole of government, except in this particular planning and research department. They said, oh, that's because it all requires hard sciences. And we said, no, changing human behavior is a matter of social and human science. So one of the recommendations we still have to get them to take up is putting gender expertise and other soft science expertise in the planning. It's a wee bit embarrassing that our national climate change response policy is being planned by men who know nothing about gender. Moving quickly ahead, our specific recommendations, and I'm not going to go into this, well, what we're trying to push for is social accounting. In other words, as we begin to make climate change response decisions, we start to look at things like how many jobs created per amount of money invested. You will see from this table that every single renewable technology creates more jobs than non-renewable, than fossil fuel and nuclear technologies. We're a little bit concerned. One of the things we're calling for is policy synergy. We're a bit concerned that the Minister for Energy is signing a deal with France around nuclear energy, when you can see it's one of the lowest job-producing technologies there is. So government is saying one thing with the mouth, but doing another with the hand, and that's a bit concerning. More figures, direct jobs per megawatt capacity, and they say the same thing. Renewable energy just simply produces more jobs, it produces sustainable jobs, it produces more decent jobs, and that's what that table is all about. Going quickly through our recommendations, food security, of course, is a huge issue. The Food and Agriculture Organization in January pointed out that world food prices are the highest since they began measuring food prices in the 1990s, and this is set to continue, and obviously high food prices has its own social stresses, political instability, clearly seeing as women are socially responsible for food purchase, production, and cooking, we think this is a huge gender issue. And we're requesting our national climate change policy to address agriculture, particularly subsistence and small-scale farming. And I can go into this more during question time. Similarly for health, prevention is better than cure. Reintroducing the primary health care system and looking very much at issues around nutrition, self-reliance, food security is again a critical health issue. Freedom of reproductive choice, the notion that we can infinitely grow our population in a finite world is a patriarchal approach to climate change that is really not going to work. And so we are saying the notion that women should really have the ability to choose whether they want to be children or not needs to be put into practice. Around transport, huge investments in public transport, and we're just highlighting the point that right now where we are, we're spending more money on the cost of fossil fuels than we actually are on building new public transport infrastructure. I just took that $225 million a year on acid mine drainage. What nobody really wants to talk about is we're going to have to do it indefinitely. There's no scientist that can tell you when we're going to be able to stop pumping AMD. And so if we're mining coal to produce fossil fuels, why are we incurring these costs for future generations? As you yourself know, Parliament's new budget act in fact says it's illegal, but we're doing it. Sorry, just skipping. Roles and responsibilities. DEA is the Clean Paper is completely inadequate on roles and responsibilities, and that may have to do with the fact that it was written by scientists. But I do believe that particular section is 5 lines, or is it 15? So we bring 18 years' experience of trying and failing to implement gender equality to the institutional infrastructure that is needed to actually implement the climate change response policy. Our first recommendation that overall responsibility should lie with a specific unit in the President's office, possibly the National Planning Commission, possibly a specific climate change minister in the presidency. I must add that during the round of public consultations that the department had, they were proposing that the responsibility for implementation should lie at local government. And we said, no, that's the same thing as not doing it. And cutting carbon emissions is too important to leave up to local government. The buck needs to stop somewhere. We say let it stop in the president's office. Overall implementation of this policy would then lie with this new ministry or unit. And there's some pulling of who really has the last say on climate change policy. Is it environmental affairs? Is it, and that's what we're saying, is that has to come to an end. The Interministerial Committee on Climate Change is having all these little boundary tussles, and it's We may fail on service delivery. We may fail on gender equality. We can't afford to fail at this. The rest is just practical implementations. What should this unit do? It should ensure that there's capacity building within government in terms of the climate change policy. It should ensure that there's capacity to implement what the climate change policy says it's going to do. And again, we understand that much of the implementation has to happen at local government level. Does local government have the capacity? If it doesn't have the capacity, who do we blame? We, the CGE, would like one institution we can go to and say, it's your fault. That is all we're asking. Again, what's the point of having a policy without a budget? We're still waiting to see what is the climate change budget going to look like, where is it going to sit, and whose responsibility is to make sure it gets spent. Skills projection, this has been raised. If we had to cut carbon emissions to zero tomorrow, we wouldn't have the skills to do it with. We're assuming that somewhere there's got to be a place in government where somebody sits and actually implements skills planning. What do we need within 3 years, 5 years, and 10 years' time? And sits in place an institutional infrastructure to make it happen. I promise you, trying to find people who have expertise in gender and climate change is really difficult. And I think this applies to all fields. Timetables, implementation plans, as a watchdog body and a civil society, we really struggle to know how we're going to hold government accountable to this national climate change response policy. And until such time as we have timetables and implementation plans, we're going to struggle to do that. Monitoring and evaluation, obviously. Consultation, in other words, if a particular unit or level of government fails to do what it's supposed to do, we want to see this place in the presidency holding it accountable. Lastly, then, a separate climate change commission set up specifically as a watchdog body for the implementation of this policy with similar powers and duties as existing Chapter 9 institutions, but obviously with a much bigger budget. I mean, we, the CGE, operate with 1 rand per South African. It's not going to be enough to monitor government's climate change work. So please, when you set up this commission, do not hamstring it by giving it a completely inadequate budget. That said, and you can see this is modeled on our national gender policy framework, even though we are advocating the setting up of a specific climate change commission, we're also saying that existing human rights institutions need to have climate change desks. That's what I do. I'm the commissioner that heads up the CG's climate change program. The Human Rights Commission, for instance, has a huge desk looking at energy and mining, and clearly we want a specific climate change point. We also want it to be mainstream throughout watchdog bodies. That's pretty much it. I'll be happy to go into more detail during question time.
Thank you, Doctor. As we know, gender cuts across everything, and the Doctor has really covered all the major aspects and particularly how it impacts on gender issues generally, but also more generally on others. Any questions? Dr. Collier?
Thank you for that presentation. Fascinating. But I just want to ask the question, do you have confidence in the Interministerial Committee on Climate Change? Given that environment and water is one ministry, given that climate change overlaps, as the chair has said, over every aspect of all the ministries, education, health, agriculture. What is your reasoning for a specific climate change ministry and minister? How feasible is this? It takes a long time for a ministry to be set up. How feasible is this? And how financially viable is it as well? I'm just interested to hear your views on that. And would it not be further fragmenting the work of the Department of Environment and Water and perhaps the work of the Interministerial Committee?
If I can add to that, if you can unpack it a bit for us, also other examples, particularly countries with same levels of development, because you see, the issue is this. I mean, if you look at our areas of mitigation and adaptation. It's water, transport, environment, health, energy, very important, rural development, etc., etc. Now, what does it mean to put them in one ministry? I mean, what are we saying? You know, and I can add to the problems you've raised about politically. I mean, you know, we've had a good example about the RDP. RDP was created to be a structure to really get over all these structures, and very quickly it ran into problems because what it starts doing, it starts duplicating in terms of things. So I'm fully on board of what you're saying about us needing to find mechanisms that properly coordinate and so on, and I'm very interested to hear what other examples there are, and just to unpack, you know, how you would suggest this one would work. Do you want to add, Doctor?
You know, looking at listening to the first presentation by the Water Research Commission, they say the area that needs to be addressed is mainstreaming climate change into existing policy. So every sector, every ministry should have that. Now you're proposing a separate ministry, and for me it's not, it's kind of in a conflict.
Other questions? Dr. Mrs. Kosana, Dr. Huang?
Chairperson, let me just request the presenter to outline, in fact, to give a recommendation on the implementation part of the structures that she has talked about, political and administrative structures. What is her recommendations? Just to unpack so that she can be broad on that.
Dr. Huang?
Thank you. I like your slide back to renewable energy, this per gigawatt, megawatt job capacity. From this side, I see that this solar PV is get this, you say direct job per gigawatt, is 62% of the this is the percentage of the number. I want to know. Then how is it calculated for this solar PV can keep the big amount for 62, more than to the other coal future and the nuclear? I'd like to get this detail. Thank you.
Mr. Njikalani?
Thank you, Chair. I must say that I thought by now there are a couple of men in South Africa who have some credibility and commitment on gender equity. Hopefully the professor one time may at least help us to generate more if there's a deficit there. Anyway, can the presenter unpack the position that with regard to the minuscule jobs generated by nuclear energy, the government is saying one thing and doing another one. I say this because my understanding is that the government drive on energy is energy mix, and therefore nuclear energy is just one of the components in supplying or generating energy in South Africa. The other question is about the climate change budget. Am I getting it correctly that there is an expectation or a proposal that there should be a budget specific for climate change? Thank you.
That for now. We'll see if there's more time. Doctor, you can respond to us, please.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for giving me the chance to clarify. We're not proposing that the work be taken away from where it's sitting at the moment. What we're saying is because it cuts across so many different policies and so many different departments, there needs to be a super minister that holds the whip for everybody else. And I'll give you just one example is on Friday we had to do submissions to the National Treasury's carbon tax proposal. Now, that still needs to come into the climate change green paper. It sits in so many different places, and who makes sure that all these different places speak to each other, work together, and actually pull in the same direction? And what we're saying is the problem is when it goes from one minister to another, the one minister can often say, but you have no authority over me. But so to have a super minister in the president's office gives it authority. And we've had this experience. The woman's minister is not here today, but if Minister Tsingwana was here, she can tell you the difference between the Office of the Status of Women sitting in the president's office and now being a minister like other ministers really complicates one's work. Similarly, your director general on Foresight, when it's the director general from the president's office, the other DGs sit up and listen. Now the woman's DG is at a level with all the other DGs. And I'm not meaning to bring this to this portfolio committee, but I'm saying from that particular experience in trying to and failing to implement gender, we're wanting to bring that to climate change. So we're not saying take it away, but we're saying put somebody in there who's bigger than everybody else and can do what needs to be done. Also, just in terms of, like I said, trying to monitor gender equality, it's easier for us if we have one desk. To have to run from department to department, trying to, and particularly when it comes to Department of Local Government, it's a nightmare. We won't have the capacity. And if monitoring doesn't get done, how do we know that we're really going to cut carbon emissions? So that's, is it financially viable? Well, meteorological science is doing a little bit of a scientific sleight of hand. They do not want to, for scientific reasons, link any individual weather event to climate change. But they're quite happy to admit that the increased frequency of weather events is linked to climate change. So if I say the department, the provincial government of KwaZulu-Natal has spent 750 million rand on flood relief in this financial year alone, then for me questions about what can we afford to spend on mitigation and adaptation don't make any sense. The floods in the Northern Cape and Limpopo has cost agriculture 1 billion rand. That cost is not being borne by the state. It's being borne by individual farmers, farm workers who've lost their jobs, people whose houses have been blown away, but society bears it. And the National Treasury submission is interesting because it says, look, we need to internalize these external costs. Somebody somewhere is paying for extreme weather. Yeah. We need to make sure that the people who are causing it actually pay, and that is the position we also support. So for us, money is sort of, if you don't spend it with the right hand, you're going to end up spending it with the left hand, and we'd rather spend it on creating jobs with renewable energy than mopping up after floods and droughts, even though scientifically we're not allowed to make that connection. I hope that responds. Chairperson, I'm very reluctant to go into the demise of the RDP because I'm going to be hopelessly politically incorrect. But frankly, that worked. The problem was because of structural adjustment, World Bank and IMF loans, we pulled out the money that was supposed to go into that ministry. But when it was there, it worked. I didn't have a problem with it. It was doing beautiful things. And similarly, this is why we're asking, where's the climate change budget? It's pointless having the institutions in place if we're not allocating the money that we need to make it work. So we can perhaps have this debate outside, but that's my position on the whole thing. I did not have a problem with the ministry, the RDP ministry. So that in sum is our recommendations. Our recommendations is a super ministry in the president's office, and we've given your written submission that exactly like we used to do with gender, that climate change needs to be mainstreamed in every government department at every level, but there also needs to be a climate change specific person. So in your local government, you have a climate change officer. It's not that person's job to implement. It's that person's job to walk around, see his local government doing what it's supposed to be doing and report to your super minister. So you have a specific focal point. You also have mainstreaming. And as far as we're concerned, that is the only way it's going to work. The World Wildlife Fund is making a submission on the 8th, so hopefully I'll invite them to go into it. Maybe you can bring copies of this. Greenpeace has done research that shows pretty much the same thing. I just found World Wildlife Fund more easier to present. This is 62 jobs per gigawatt generated, and why solar photovoltaic produces such a high ratio of jobs, it's calculated on the basis that we start producing our own photovoltaic panels inside the country. So these calculations are done at looking at what does it cost to produce a particular technology. If we import our photovoltaic panels from Germany, then obviously it will produce less jobs. But yes, so I'm going to leave to World Wildlife. I'm going to go into the exact science of how they calculate this. But I'm certainly not questioning their research. My point is it creates jobs with a factor of, 1 to 100, 1 to 200. And these are quite high differentials.
Can I follow up with this question?
There are plenty of feminist men, sir. They do not appear to be sitting in the Department of Environmental Affairs. That was all we were trying to say. My point about government is... Yes, exactly. We're also specifically calling for gender expertise. I mean, gender equality is a constitutional demand, but we're also saying if you want to end climate change, can you please have some people sitting there that know something about gendered behavior? The problem with the Minister of Energy signed contracts around nuclear energy is that the Integrated Resource Plan 2, which, now here we go, falls under the Department of Energy, but also falls under this particular green paper. It specifically mentions it. Has not been completed yet. We had IRP1 late 2009. They said, we just have to put this together, but we're going to come back and consult with you. They came back and consulted with us around IRP2. Everybody made submissions. We have not yet had a final Integrated Resource Plan 2 policy that is going to plan our energy usage for the next 20 years. But before that policy is completed, contracts are being signed that are going to commit us to storing radioactive waste for the next 500 years. That is not democracy. That is not governance. That is not citizenship. And in point, in fact, it's illegal. I'm not going to start quoting the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, but surely the essence of a consultation process is before you sign contracts and make commitments, you complete the process of consultation. That has now not happened. And I can go into it. There's mining licenses. There's mines that have been started without water. There's natural gas exploration. But this is why we're saying there needs to be one person that pulls all of this together and says, I don't want you arguing mining energy, water affairs, whatever, we are going to settle it in this way. At this point, if I want to hold somebody responsible, I have to go to four departments and shout at all of them. That is what is making the system not work. And as I say, we can continue not working the system, but these floods are real. These droughts are real. We really can't not deliver on this. I think that's all our questions, Chair, and thanks for the rhetoric.
Justice, because clearly policy doesn't fall under admin justice. It doesn't. I drafted the act. I should know what the admin justice is. Admin justice is specific decisions made on affecting an individual person. That is what admin justice is. And then, of course, you have the right to. So I'm not arguing with you whether, because I can't argue with you whether there's been enough consultation or not. But consultations are different issues. It's got nothing to do with the constitutionality of the issue. I mean, what you should do is you should tackle the political parties that have nuclear as their policy. Then that debate can be had there. But definitely you can't come with say that it's unconstitutional. It just cannot be unconstitutional. It can be undesirable. Some people can disagree with it, don't like it, but I think we should leave it at that. There's still a little bit of time. Is there still one or two follow-up questions? Dr. Huang, do you have a follow-up question? There's still some time?
Yes, I think, Chairperson, I think it's for at least two figures. Because you can back reverse to the other side for the per investment of $1 million for the job. So from this one, I just see from solar and the nuclear, this is quite a big difference.
So I want to know why this one, where is the target, is the figure you get from. I want to know. Because the investment, the 1 million rand, is a, can get this about this amount of job. Then now if you come back to the, this total amount, the nuclear, is more expensive to the solar PV. So I want to know what, what's this figure you can calculate like this job is total. Thank you.
Any others, Pollux? Any others? No? Okay. Ah, Doctor, how are you? Have you also come to visit us? Doctor, no more question?
Sorry, I was touching the wrong button. Now, I just I listened to an argument this morning about IRP2 positions that according to the IRP2 draft, nuclear and renewable are going to make 50% and the fossil 50% in the foreseeable 20 years to come, according to that IRP2 paper. So I just want, and there was an argument, there was one person who was a pro-nuclear person who was saying that he can't understand why this IRP2 should accept that position that it will be 50-50 between nuclear and renewable, because renewable cannot be really taken serious for industrial production and outputs. So he didn't understand who really advised the government that the nuclear must also must go 50% with renewable. So can you clarify probably that position about IRP2?
Thank you, Chairperson. With reference to the promotion of Administrative Justice Act, I'm not sure what you had in mind when you wrote the law, but I just want to refer you to the Louis Trichardt judgment that went to the High Court, but the state never appealed it to the Constitutional Court. I'll be happy to email you that exact judgment. Yes. At the Supreme Court. Thank you. So yes, having the... thank you. Now let me just see if I got the how the figures are calculated. Let's just use solar energy as an example. When we build a nuclear power station, we import the technology from France. When it breaks down, we have to fly in engineers from France to do it, all at fabulous cost. And obviously this cost is not calculable because it depends on the exchange rate. So, in a sense, we're exporting jobs. Part of the way these figures are calculated is essentially we're importing, we're ceasing to export jobs, we're creating the technologies ourselves here. An even better example is oil. The minute we start producing biofuels, we will cease to export jobs to Saudi Arabia or Libya, and we will be creating those jobs here. Now, there are very clear calculations around this. For every one South African that has work, that person supports about two or three other South Africans. That person also employs, and I think the multiplier, I can't swear to it, but it's something like between 1.2 and 2. In other words, I have a job. If I'm at a certain income level, I buy things that are produced in South Africa. I buy mealie meal, I buy more red meat, I buy milk. Let me not say clothes and shoes. Let me think what we still produce. I buy beadwork. And so I give more work to South Africans. For every liter oil that we import from some other country, that person in that country employs other people. So this is the reason why fossil fuels tend to create such a low level of jobs. Now, again, this research was not produced by the CG. It was produced by the World Wildlife Fund, and I'm sure that they'll be happy to go into the science with you. But as for the economy of what local production does, whether it's energy, whether it's food, and the job multiplier effect of that, I'm absolutely certain. The more we produce in this country, the more jobs we will create. If I can add, you know, and again, World Wildlife Fund has done some interesting projections around this. Places like the Northern Cape are the most suited places in the world to produce solar energy. So, you know, I really don't understand why we aren't doing it. Excuse me, there was one last question that I missed now. Sorry, if somebody can just remind me. Oh. I was trying to look at my file for that, but now I didn't bring it. Essentially, our problem is if you pretend to consult. Now, consultation doesn't just mean that you must come ask us what we think. Once we've said what we think, there's supposed to be some sign or signal that we've actually been heard. And like I say, the fact that before that process is completed, contracts are already being signed, doesn't make any sense. Yes, the version of IRP2 that went out for consultation was looking at something like very high ratios of nuclear energy. Now, as far as I know, only two organizations supported that. Surprise, one was the Nuclear Producers Association, and the other one was the Nuclear Scientists. All the other organizations that submitted on nuclear energy said no nuclear for a range of different reasons. But now, when the final IRP2 then comes out, what are the dynamics that then influences our energy choices over the next 20 years? And what does democracy mean when two very rich and very influential organizations can outvote another 180 organizations? That is the part that I'm questioning. Our job is to safeguard the democracy of this country. And when things like that happen, in this particular case, process hasn't even been concluded and already decisions are being made, then, you know, what did we fight for? I just don't get it. If we're going to have a democracy, then we need to have it in substance and not just in rhetoric. Thank you, Chair.
committee chair for the opportunity, and to the committee for extending invitation to the Council of Churches to make submission. I need to override your request to waive protocol. I've been asked to communicate the apologies of the President of the South African Council of Churches, the Reverend Dr. Joe Sioka, who would have been here to do this presentation. Unfortunately, he has been in Durban and has to cut short his trip to Cape Town, or postpone his trip to Cape Town. About prayers, and I hope that at the end of the day we'll be singing off the same hymn sheet. What we're trying to do is to, I found this very fascinating exercise in science and the politics of climate change, and what I hope to be sharing is a moral and ethical analysis of a crisis that is of a human, social, and spiritual nature, and it's therefore regarded by the Council of Churches as a justice issue. The Council of Churches would hope that two things would be flowing from this exercise. The one is that South Africa will deliver on its emission reduction commitments after the 16 protocols, or 16 years of protocols, and there's been plenty of time to deal with the issues and come to a way forward that recognizes the impacts that climate change has, particularly disproportionately on the poorest, most vulnerable people and on our environment. So for the churches in particular and the faith communities, climate change is a social, a moral, and a spiritual crisis. And so perhaps if we could get to preparing to host the 17th conference, we would recommend that we do that in solidarity and with urgency and with the poorest and most vulnerable in our nation and in the world. So here to say basically a very simple message. Is that this is, as you've said, a serious issue, and how do we deal with this in the most serious and urgent manner possible? I think we must point out that we know the 2 degrees centigrade target that was agreed at after Copenhagen is a weak compromise. It's an embarrassment that developing nations, and South Africa too, has had to cut out to wealthier nations. We hope that at the end of this discussion and exercise over 3 weeks and 6 days of discussion, serious thought would be given to the 110 countries' least developed nations that last year had called at the COP16 to consider for aiming at a goal limiting further warming by 1.5 degrees rather than 2 degrees. We all know that 2 degrees is the target that's been offered by wealthier nations, developed countries. The South African Council of Churches welcomes the paper and the climate change response strategy, but rejects the attempt to accommodate developed countries and our own intensive energy economy in a strategic compromise to recognize and address this, and also create mechanisms that will give high carbon sectors the support and time to move to lower carbon forms of production, page 7 of the paper. The South African Council of Churches says that South Africa should stand unequivocally and in solidarity with the poorest developing countries that are bearing the brunt of developed countries' historical actions that have and continue to harm the world. The SACC says that South Africa is in a favorable position to reject all attempts at carbon trading and carbon footprint trading and set a standard of global accountability on those historically responsible for the diseased global environment that we enjoy at this moment. There are two things I think, I hope that we're on the same page, and we just want to raise that we understand each other. For us in the churches, mitigation means interventions to reduce greenhouse gases and or enhance carbon sinks. Secondly, that adaptation means responses that increase the ability of human and ecological subsistence systems to manage or cope with climate change. For us, climate change means tackling both mitigation and adaptation effectively and as equitably as possible. Are we on the same page, sir? Committee. Mitigation and adaptation. So let's just address the issues that have been brought for adaptation and mitigation responses, water, agriculture, and human health adaptation responses. SSCC believes that all adaptation strategies should be viewed as urgent in the short, medium, and long term. While we support the department and Green Paper's imperative to ensure that we can sustain affordable water for all, we call on the department, and I'm changing words here, to legislate that all levels of the government will act cooperatively to ensure water resources on local and regional level and enforce that the polluter pays principle and ensures that water sources are fit for drinking without compromise of solvents or pollutants. On agriculture, the SSCC commends the reports and work by the United Nations Framework on Climate Change, Committee on Climate Change. The establishment of the subsidiary body for scientific technological advice, the SBSTA, 5-year work program on impacts, vulnerability, and adaptation on climate change. I believe it's based in Nairobi. I didn't see any reference to it in the paper, but this may well be a useful body that we don't have to start research, this research wheel all over and over. But being in Africa could provide a useful form of information on alternate strategies for agricultural adaptation. On human health, sir, the SSCC affirmed the approaches in the Green Paper's dealing with human health as the heart of climate justice. The SSCC advises that in conjunction with the Department of Health, further adaptation strategies be integrated to and rolled out in conjunction with the proposed national health insurance, which is an equitable and just way of dealing with the nation's burden of disease. We believe that rather than calling for that to fund a very important project in our nation, that we look seriously at the polluter pays principle. It could form a really valid source of income for the plan. On climate justice mitigation sectors, on energy, the SSCC affirms its approach in the draft integrated research plan 2010 on energy electricity, that energy justice is about finding rapid alternatives to the cheap but dirty source of energy that is coal. For environmental, social, health, and economic perspectives, the SSCC urges government to immediately explore the path of renewable energy. Churches and other faith communities have positive awareness roles to play in promoting lessons on energy efficiency and renewable energy as mitigation for climate change. Note, churches understand that the scientific evidence does not uphold nuclear energy as either a renewable energy or sustainable energy source. I'm not going to get into that discussion. I hope you don't ask me any questions about that. I think it's clear. Business and commerce, I think the issue is, we said, is that how ready these sectors to adapt to the climate change responses can only be dealt with from these sectors themselves. However, we want to just highlight for you some declarations that have emerged from the alternative mining in Durban. It was held between churches, communities in Africa at the same time as the mining in Durban was held at the beginning of February. And there we heard a very interesting participatory exercise of research that was done, listening to stories from communities that have been affected by mining, extractive mining. That Indaba had presented a declaration to the Minister of Minerals and Mining. I just raised some of the issues here, which raised for us that there is a synergy and there needs to be a complementarity between ecological justice, social justice, economic justice, and cultural justice. The issues that were raised that could be of importance for dealing with the fallouts or the consequences of mining corporations is that the communities are demanding free, prior, and informed consent before, during, and after mining events have been entered to or contracts entered into between government and mining companies. Genuine participation of traditional leaders with communities as accountable servants of communities is demanded. Environmental and social impact assessments need to be conducted by experts independent of government and private sector interests. Greater transparency from these companies to declare revenues, taxes, levies, and royalties according to the SACA Declaration of Mining and publish what you pay is an interesting way of possibly gaining further revenue. Governance when companies are stashing their profits ashore, hold mining companies and their shareholders accountable under the polluter pays principle for rehabilitation and a community restoration required by mining and its resultant degradation. Finally, and in conclusion, the church is saying government is to be commended for defining climate change as all of our business, as its strategy as a partnership with South African people to empower people and give them understanding, choice, and control over climate-related decisions that affect their daily lives and work. I think Commissioner Abrams is hinting at the importance of that, but in reality, what we've discovered in the DIFRP is exactly what she's been saying, is that the resultant decisions do not point out to the weight of arguments that come from civil society. So what kind of consultation and partnership is that? We point out that South Africa already possesses sophisticated democracy with checks and balances, including a constitutionally mandated process of consultation, participatory decision-making, and these need to be explored. We look forward to proposals from the white paper, but continue to seek clarity on the kind of partnership that would defer the divine government's intent on making climate change the business of all. We could further point to the partnerships with the People's Budget Campaign as possible areas of cooperation as well. How am I doing for time? Can I go? We haven't pointed out, and I've realized that we've left in our paper, we've substantially tried to mull over the relationship with government, what is the best mix, whether an intergovernmental mechanism might deal with the issue of climate change. We note the problems that have emerged with other areas of work, where these worked and have not worked. And perhaps we are saying is that perhaps a mix and combination needs to be tried of possibly a placing this as a common standing agenda points on each department, having a center-coordinated interministerial mechanism. But what needs to be importantly defined, particularly for research and for communication of issues, you raised the communication, sir, is certainly a defined partnership with civil society that works and that uses the dignity, respect of consultation seriously if we're going to take this as a justice issue that is affecting particularly the poorest communities and the most marginalized and vulnerable communities. There, too, the churches have a large role to play in mitigating in behavior, attitudes, and choices, but also in communicating the best options of renewable choices and what works for the best of all. Thank you, sir.
Much appreciated. You raise many, many issues. Ladies and gentlemen, time for questions. Dr. Ngobo.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much to the Reverend for the good presentation, which seems to be very dedicated to defending the poor people. I only have one slight problem in the presentation where the Reverend is talking about the understanding of the church, that the church has no scientific evidence which upholds that nuclear energy is sustainable. I can't remember what the sentence was. It's sustainable, renewable, and so forth.
As either a renewable and or a sustainable energy source.
Yeah. No, I do differ with the Reverend. There is scientific evidence that actually one component of nuclear energy, which is fusion energy, nuclear energy is derived from fission energy source or fusion energy source. The fusion energy source is very scientifically proven to be both sustainable, renewable, and even fail-safe. Because it is mainly consisting of very abundant elements of nature, lithium, hydrogen, helium, and graphite, which is carbon. So therefore, I think the Reverend must revise that sentence because it spoils the document, which is otherwise good. Thank you very much.
Any other questions or comments? We don't want to tackle the representative of the Almighty. Dr. Kalyan?
I just want to make a comment. You know, there seems to be this pattern that we must always worry about the wealthier countries, and I think we should stay away from that and rather focus on solutions rather than worrying about America or, you know, whichever wealthy countries. But I just have a tongue-in-cheek remark, sir, and, you know, take it in the spirit that I'm giving it. From the church's point of view, how does the polluter principle work? Because, I mean, surely the church says people mustn't be punished.
The bigger problem, as we found with the mines, is that they're not around anymore. They extracted things and then they ran, and now there's an empty mine and no one has it. So it's going to be difficult to punish them. Unless you know what, of course. Yeah, you can play an important role, Reverend. But those people get in another place. Maybe that's the time to get hold of them. You may not be there, but that's the place to get hold of them. Can I just look on the issues of justice and all those things that you raise? I don't think any sane person can disagree with those things. But the consequence of it, you see, when you say that you reject the attempt to accommodate developed countries and our energy-intensive economy in a strategic compromise, and then you quote, to recognize and address this and also create mechanisms that will give high carbon sectors. Now, you say you reject that. That we must start adapting the carbon-intensive part of our economy to a less... Now, if you reject that we're going to move this process, and of course we can debate how quick we move it, but then what's the alternative? Do we just totally and utterly put that in the end? And then secondly, although it's not directly linked to the paper, but it's probably an outcome of the paper, what would you suggest must South Africa's positions be then? I mean, we're at a place now where America and Japan and all the host of the top countries that pay or are going to pay for a lot of this are withdrawing. They're not going to agree to Kyoto again. So the little sword we have hanging over them at the moment is gone from the 2012. So what are you suggesting South Africa's position should be in rejecting all the attempts to at least create those mechanisms that will deal with some of these issues? So I read what you're saying. I'm trying to work out what you are saying will the outcome then be. Mr. Morgan, add to something there.
Thank you, Chair. With regards to the same point that you've queried on reject the attempt to accommodate developed countries in our own energy-intensive economy, could you then give us your views or critique of the long-term mitigation scenarios for South Africa and the peak plateau decline scenarios which are presented for really the periods between 2025 and 2030. I'm particularly interested in whether you question the science behind that, whether the business as usual is too ambitious is really an incorrect trajectory, and whether there are, in your opinion, of ways where the peak plateau demand should be sooner and more severe thereafter than it currently is set for 2000 and 2030. Then I'm well aware of
several arguments about carbon trading. I'm very interested if you could further give us comments on why specifically you oppose carbon trading and the risks associated with carbon trading as well, in your opinion. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Chairperson Johnson.
Thank you, Chair. In the same token that you have alluded to, that you know, the preacher is never his or her word is never disputed. You know, here Dr. Mabo here, you know. Because when they're in the pulpit, you know, all the congregants, they, after having listened, go and implement. I'm imagining here, yeah, having read the presentation, it really does talk more to, you know, the wealthier, the developed, you know, the polluter pays principle. But equally important for me is that role that the pulpit must play in really forming part of a broader education public exercise, because that begins and becomes quite a very, very important and effective platform, as it were. I think if we were also to emphasize on that, not only by word, also by the actions that follow, because it's a perfect, you know, platform, if I were to say, like you have heard during the, you know, struggles against apartheid, the church and the word that he could have been preaching, it really made it possible, among others, for today to be saying to ourselves, yes, we are indeed free against, you know, apartheid colonialism, as having been led by, you know, some of us who are here today. Thank you.
On a lighter note, Dr. Abrams maybe should have quoted the churches a bit more in terms of the certainty that you've created than the one, the WWF. Maybe you'll have much more clout if you do it with the churches. But that's on a lighter, that's on a lighter note. Reverend... Reverend, actually, maybe you guys should start quoting the churches as well. Reverend, respond to those, please.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. I find these all fascinating and very, very interesting questions. I don't profess to have the answers to you, and probably would have shown it to that the President should be here and was going to be answering these questions. Cannot do that. But let me start. I think the last question is a very from Chair Johnson. The difference between being a preacher and being a representative of the churches in terms of public policy are two totally different areas. And yes, I'm not expecting the portfolio committee to, or maybe I should, take just what I'm saying and just can implement that. But just to say that that's never been my style of preaching either. It's been a sense of dialogue and sharing as a finite human being what I believe are huge principles beyond our comprehension sometimes. And sometimes it's comprehensible, incomprehensible why we act in certain ways. But to say is that, yes, the education role is what we're trying to work out, the awareness that we need to create within our membership. It's important to sort out the understanding of where we're going to on dealing with climate change, that we may, for argument's sake, two areas that I've mentioned are important that we want to share about energy efficiency, but how we can save and not waste. And that goes for the water that's been shared, and I think the information that we've got with energy, fundamentally important issues to be dealing with. And then, of course, the understanding is that certainly within the churches globally in the World Council of Churches, is that renewables are a far healthier and a cleaner source of energy, able to create jobs, but also to create a much healthier future, with which we should be able to persuade our constituency to engage, to utilize, and to promote. So, yes, it's about action, it's about teaching, but I don't believe that the presentation that I'm making here is a sermon that should not be challenged. I think that's point number one. I want to come to the question, Dr. Kalyan. That's precisely the issue, is that what the churches and what the churches believe and teach are not necessarily what is legislated within a government. And I'm by no means kind of saying is that because we believe A, B, and C, I'm wanting to foist that on this portfolio committee. This is a valid, secular, constitutional democracy, and I think we've got to be open as with everybody else to put our ideas. One of the issues for argument's sake is that it may well be, I'm not too sure, I dispute your claim that the church is saying, is that you should not be punishing the polluter, is that there are very clear constitutional guarantees and rights in terms of whoever misuses the resources within our country, in terms of justice, that a penalty must be paid. We see that in the scriptures that we read, where there's a breaking of not just the law, the legal bind, but particularly of social, human, and personal relationships. There is always a price to be paid, and the price to be paid in church language is about restoring those relationships much less than it is about punishing the one who's broken, breaking those. However, I think we're dealing with a social, economic, and cultural bind of laws. I mentioned in terms of, and certainly we've met with about 100 communities in the 1st of February who have said to us, you should have seen the stories told of people with disfigured faces, their animals dying as a result of pollutants that emerged from extractive mining in Tanzania, in Kenya, in the DRC, and so on. Does the church say is that God doesn't punish? I don't think so. The church has said two things, is that we will hold us before accountable authorities responsible, and that's why I'm raising the issue of polluter pays, because I do believe is that it's government's responsibility to hold accountable politically and legally where society willfully goes against breaking the relationships that should be used and resources should be used for the good of everyone. So I hope that gives you some kind of indication of where I'm coming from and responding to the church and the church's role. But I find it very, very fascinating is that we are open to hear and listen to the responses of the churches. And I would as well add, there would be other churches and other church formations and faith formations that would have possible different reflections in the way in terms of how that may be dealt with. But this is what I believe the Council of Churches in its ecumenical tradition has been working towards in terms of holding the polluter pays accountable, is that those who break the laws of society must be prepared to be accountable. Christians have scripture, I'm not going to quote chapter and verse, where that is applied as well. The question on Dr. Noble, I'm not a scientist. I fully accept your explanation. What I've been alluding to is that in my reading, there is no one scientific tradition that says nuclear is renewable and let me put it this way. There are contesting views on the renewability and the safety of nuclear. And I think as churches, we need to be open to that explanation as well. We have made extensive submission to departments of environmental affairs in the past, saying is that our concern is largely what happens to the waste? What happens to future generations? who pays for that decision that we make right now? And I think there's no way that we can speak of clean energy, nuclear being a clean energy source, in the same sense that we are speaking of renewable sun, wind, water, and wave, contributing to a clean and a healthy environment in the same sense that nuclear is able. I'll take that up and I'll go do some more reading around it. I don't have a full answer in terms of that scientifically, but that's in my limited scientific reading, that there's a for and against side, and it's not gospel. Gospel in the sense that it dictates to me this is something that you abide by and live by. The position of South Africa, Chair, Kyoto, and the wealthier nations are going to be funding COP7. Is it that's the major problem of these conference of parties? That's been the major problem where Kyoto has been sidelined and shelved, and if life comes to an end in 2012, surely we can ask ourselves, do we go through a position where there's going to be a compromise called for, particularly by the wealthier nations? We cannot get away from the wealthier nations, because this is not an issue that we just deal with within our own community and our nation. This is a global issue, and we've got to look at our relationship with those who have historically caused this problem. So we cannot say let them be. I mean this is the concern I would understand. It's not as though we're dealing with apartheid that has been created internally and has its effects on the population of South Africa. This has been created over centuries, particularly by wealthy nations, and we too are bearing the brunt as are more. Disproportionately the poor, of the poor arts of those effluents and the pollutants into the air and so on. So what do we do? I'm suggesting is that we give thought to being the ethical global leader that we are. That this is an urgent issue. That this is an issue. It is a crisis of global proportions. That we as a nation were able to take a moral stand against apartheid must surely be on the lines in thinking of our political leaders as we lead the discussions in COP17. And all I'm asking is half a degree. Half a degree would make an enormous difference in showing the rest of Africa and least developed countries who we're standing with and where we are siding with. But we could go to 2 degrees, which will probably be stretched to 4 degrees, if we want to ensure that we get some trade-off from the wealthier countries at the end of the day and don't spoil our economic relations with them. We might not spoil our economic relations. I think in terms of our human relations, that we need to give some thought to what would emerge from that. Carbon trading, well, I oppose. I think my understanding is that you're simply just placing the problem in another area and accepting to take the financial trade of ecological damage that's been created by wealthier nations. I understand you that certainly within the global discussions of the churches, the World Council of Churches, is that we've been pressurized and called to say no to carbon trading. No to carbon trading so that we offset the programs that we choose to operate in the next 20, 30 years in setting at least this environment right for future generations. Rather than continuing with business as usual, trading perhaps a jet travel for a trip to pay for it, giving him a free trip or giving a subsidized trip to Kruger National Park or something like that. It doesn't make any sense to me. And I think the churches have been saying is that in their analysis, carbon trading is not something that is going to solve the issue or bring us closer to mitigation or adaptation, but worsen the situation for us. I'm not sure what I've left out there because I can't read my own writing at this time of the day, Chair. But I do think there have been some very important questions that would bear me to go back and look at a reconfigured response, perhaps most important of all, the issue of the relationship within government and the most effective mechanism within government to deal with the issue. I certainly will go back and do some more reflection on the nuclear issue. By the way, I was not saying it's the churches, I was saying it's the understanding of the scientific analysis is not clear.
Dr. Ngobo?
No, I'm willing to meet with him.
Meet with him outside.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Convert him to nuclearism. I think the issue is there's a debate and some people agree and some disagree, and that's fine. You've got some support there.
Well, let me just give. I mean, the offhand church response to nuclear, when someone said it's a necessary evil, the bishop said it's more evil than necessary.
Well, he should know because he can draw that line. Can I just say, thank you very much. And
thank you, Chair.
Look, I mean, I actually found today very interesting, as I always do, public hearings, because I really like engaging, and particularly when it's intellectual on the one side, but it's also kind of absolutely vital for our future existence to engage on these issues. And as I said, I don't think there are right and wrong answers to these climate change issues, and that we should debate them and we should listen to each other. But I do think, Reverend, that it would be good to think a bit. I'm new at this stuff. I actually know nothing about it, absolutely nothing. I'm just a very doer lawyer that plods in a certain way, thinks in a certain way. So, these areas have been very interesting to me. But I must say, yesterday I asked this question to the representative of the WWF and to other people, And this issue of us being absolute Puritans in the sense of engaging the international community, we need to look at that and say that is really what I want our government to do. I mean, clearly our government should have an ethical base which they don't go below, which we should expect from them. But, the positions we, for example, put across at COP and so on, those are highly representative, and it's a common position we put from Africa. So when you talk about poor countries and so on and we should engage, you can't get poorer than in the rest of Africa. I mean, the group of 77, including China and so on, are exactly the kind of people that we have our positions with. And that's the one thing. You see, the other thing is, when you negotiate and when you're discussing with things, you can't say to people, well, we're going to start on the basis that you're totally guilty for this, and only you're going to bear the brunt, and only you're going to take responsibility, and the rest of us are just going to make sure that you do it. So, all the issues you say, we must reject this and that, I think there should be some thought. I personally have asked people, has anyone analyzed what happens to this whole area of negotiation in the world after 2012? 2012, the big polluters and the people with the money are walking away from Kyoto. They have said it quite categorically. So, you've got the two streams for negotiations. The one basically becomes dysfunctional, extinct. It's there, it's a protocol, but it's got no force of effect whatsoever. Everything that we've done and everything that exists at the moment, the funds, all the agreements we've got, are based on that existing with the two streams. And the chances are, I would say, 100%, that after 2012, when Kyoto Protocol has no binding ability to those countries which we're bound through it, that the only issue then is the second stream, and that is negotiating a new agreement. Now, we've negotiated the new one many years ago. We took 17 COPs to get where we are now, which has still got huge things that we haven't achieved. It took 17 COPs to get there. By 2012, we're back where we were 17 years ago. Because all those commitments that the developed world has agreed to are basically going to be gone. So I do think, you know, I mean, we are going to face huge issues at the end of this year and by 2012 in terms of negotiating this thing that we want to do, an agreement that will make this planet be able to sustain itself. And I still have to read the paper of the WWF. Apparently some of these issues were raised there. But I do think as a nation, we have to start debating this, because we may go to COP17 having great expectations of what we're going to do, but the major countries are already, so we're walking away from all this stuff. And then we are faced with huge, huge issues. And then to actually start saying, well, you can't compromise with the developing world, and we must be, you know, we've got huge problems in doing that. So I don't want any response from it, because I don't think it's directly related to the, but I do think, you know, the church needs to also look at these issues so that they can be part of that debate, because there's no doubt, as we go now to COP17, there's going to be a lot of space for us as a parliament, as civil society, to debate all the kind of things we want to see at COP. And I hope that this kind of discussions we're having now can kickstart some of those debates, so that we have some real debates, because at the end of this year and the beginning of next year, we are facing huge difficulties as far as the basis for negotiations that exist today. But as I say that, I really mean it when I say thank you for your hard work. I know it's difficult to fit in things in 10 minutes, at least you can be assured we read these papers beforehand, and we engage as well as we can. Tomorrow morning we start at 8:30, please. We'll probably end a bit earlier than we thought, because one of the inputs has withdrawn, has an ill mother, so in Sri Lanka, so they can't give an input. So we'll at least have one less, so hopefully we'll finish a bit earlier tomorrow. Thank you very much, and I'll see you tomorrow, 8:30 in the old assembly chamber. A lot of space, bring your whole family. In fact, bring the community, bring your dogs and cats, and we'll have a lot of space for everyone there. See you tomorrow morning.